two. One more
time. Welcome to Hungry Magazine Culinary Podcasting. All of our podcasts can be found at www.hungrymag.com. This week we sat down with Chef Noah Bukowski of Aria Restaurant in Chicago's Fairmont Hotel.
You started working in a restaurant when you were 14. What was that experience? Where were you at?
I was in a town in Oregon, Eugene, Oregon, and it was family friends that owned a restaurant, and I kind of started doing the holiday fairs and working the booths with them. Then I started working in the restaurants doing, dishes and making salads, and it was a small 4-star restaurant that had, in the mid-80s, they still had the farmers that came to the back door and sold the greens, and, the fish guys that would come by and you'd buy off the back of the trucks, and it was only like 25 seats, but it was very high-end, and so that was my first experience into the food business. Was really kind of hands-on, and they had an outside courtyard as well that they grew the herbs in, and so it was
really all
very high-end and organics and all about the seasonality of it, and the menu changed every week.
What was the name of the restaurant?
Cafe Central.
Cafe Central.
At this point, it's long gone.
Yeah.
So.
Was that when you knew? I mean, was that the place where you said, this is the career that I'm going to embark on, or?
Luckily or unlucky, when I was really young, I knew what I wanted to do. My parents say by the time I was 8 or 9 years old, I said I was going to be a chef. And so that's what I had always wanted to do, and I always cooked. And I grew up in a household that was all about food and seasonality, and it was, the first 8, 9, 10 years of my life was all macrobiotics.
Oh, really?
It was very extreme organics and very, seasonality and all vegetarian. And then we had our gardens. And then we branched out as a kid, my brother and sister and I grew up. We kind of branched out from there. And it was always cooking in the house and always gardens in the backyard. And so I was always raised around food and I loved it. And so, some kids' early memories may be making grilled cheese sandwiches. Mine's brown rice and miso soup with watercress. So it's a little different than other kids, but the same sort of thing in the kitchen and cooking and the smells.
So was it pretty much a vegetarian existence growing up? Or?
Yeah, pretty much. And then once I probably hit high school, junior high and high school, some cheeses and then fish and chicken, but never any red meat.
Yeah.
Never any red. My experience with red meat and stuff trying a lot of that stuff was when I was in the restaurant. And it's being such a small restaurant that I started at, even at a young age, I was able to do the wine tastings and I was able to do those things because everybody knew I was there and it was more of an education than drinking the wines. And so it was, a different sort of experience.
Was that a point of contention with your folks when you started sampling meat and doing stuff with that, or was that?
I think it was a little bit, but at the same time, it wasn't in the house, and it was more so for educational purposes. But of course, educational purposes, when you're a kid and you try red meat and you have a burger and you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you familiar with chez panisse and greens and all that kind of stuff when you were growing up?
Yeah, I mean, when I was really young and much younger, I lived in San Jose and Ben Lomond and Los Gatos and Santa Cruz and some areas right around there. And so, at a very young age, I kind of saw some of those sorts of things. And growing up on the West Coast, that's in the Northwest, from San Francisco to Seattle, that's what it's all about. Even then, the whole idea of the fresh greens and edible flowers and all that stuff is, once I left there, I realized how much it had been ingrained in me and how much it wasn't everywhere else at the time I was doing it. It was 10, 15 years later that it started to show up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I finally got a chance to eat there last year and I loved it. I was, we went to the French Laundry as well on that trip, and it's funny because we ate at a lot of places while we were there, but those were the two that I remembered, the French Laundry and Chez Panisse, and it's funny, 30 years later, they're still doing it, it's amazing.
Yeah, those two, for me, it's those two, and then John Ash as well. I mean, it's those three really that have made that foundation for so many chefs to go through there and blossom and grow, and it really is, it's all about the food. I mean, even here, no matter how hard we try to get the freshest produce in, or even from the markets in the summer, the greens taste different out there, and the produce, it's just different. You get, mescaline mixed greens, and it just looks different and tastes different when you're in that environment there. I mean, it's just like anywhere. You go to France, a baguette's going to taste a lot better than it does here, and it may be the same exact ingredients.
Right. It's the terroir, or whatever they say it is.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at the menu, the Aria menu, at least the one that's online, and I noticed you had some Kumamotos from Oregon. Is that something that you knew about because of what you grew up and worked out there, or is that how? I know. I guess I noticed a lot of influences. It seems like you have. I know you get some the Hawaiian Big Eye, as well, and some of the Escalar, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So, you're bringing a lot of what you've learned so far, I think, to the restaurant. Is that the case?
That's a lot of it. I try to bring like the best of wherever I've lived or wherever I've worked into the restaurants and stuff where I'm at. And you know, the Kumamoto's, I think, are almost a mainstream oyster now that everybody tends to really like them. You know, growing up out there, there's hundreds of different varieties like right along the coast that you can go and get, but they always seem to taste the sweetest and have the best flavor for them. And the same with the tuna. I mean, I don't think you can get a better tuna than a Big Eye tuna from Ahi from Hawaii. It doesn't, you know, you get yellowfin from wherever else, it just doesn't taste the same.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality of it's different. And you know, and then from being out there, I learned that the tuna out there is healthier for you because the mercury content is lower in the fish. And this is what I'm reading from, I'm seeing from the doctors out there, because the waters are cleaner.
Yeah.
So the fish, not only is it fresher, but it's actually better for you, because they even allowed women that were pregnant, because it's such a part of the staple diet out there is raw tuna,
mm-hmm.
whether it's pokey or whatever it ends up being in, it's such a part of the diet, and the doctors there say it's okay. Because there's such a less amount of mercury that's in it.
Yeah, there was a lot of industrial revolution in Hawaii, you know, at least of the same sense here in Chicago or Detroit or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it tough to get those foodstuffs from those places? I mean, I would guess Aria's, you know, you guys are running, you do breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and
mm-hmm.
you probably have high demands for some of these producers. Is that tough for you guys? Like, I was thinking about, I know you do a lot of stuff at the Green City Market, and but my thought would be that it would be tough for you guys to get a lot of that, you know, good produce for Aria. Maybe that's not the case. I don't know.
The produce can be a challenge. I mean, especially this time of year, you're pulling from Mexico and then Chile and Israel and Florida. You know, the California, Oregon, Washington really doesn't set in. I mean, Southern California always, but during the winter and early parts of spring, it's a challenge to get, you know, the quality of the produce that's in. But as, you know, late spring, summer rolls in, the produce around here is fantastic. And, yeah, I go to the market twice a week. I think everybody kind of saw, a lot of people saw me down there on Wednesdays and Saturdays, you know, carrying boxes and loading stuff around. I fell in love with the market, you know, really last year. I'd been there the year before because it was like, that was my first year here, and then experimented and saw a bunch of different markets, and that ended up being the one that I, you know, really liked to go to, and then really kind of connected with a bunch of the different farmers that were there and bought a lot of stuff from them.
So have you on occasion like gone down to the market and bought some stuff and then cooked it for like a lunch or dinner here? Like, or is it usually you'll just negotiate with those farmers to have them deliver to the restaurant? Or have you just done, do you do spontaneous stuff like that where you?
Both, actually. I mean, last year I tried to get some of it delivered, but generally it didn't really work out. So I would literally, you know, take my rig down there on Wednesdays and load up what I needed from Wednesday to Saturday and go down there on Saturday and load up for, you know, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. So it was literally picking up from the market. And I got some of a relationship with some of them to, like, grow, and so I knew what I was going to get. But the rest of it was, all right, what looks good? Do you have a case? Do you have two cases? Or what it was.
So how's this experience been different than, you know, what you did in Kapalua and, you know, in Oregon? You know, how's the Chicago experience and Aria been so far for you?
Aria's been a great experience, and I think that, you know, the restaurant itself continues to grow and grow and gain more publicity and gain more of a following, and the food continues to evolve into, you know, the culturally inspired, comfortably American genre as it was. And that's really blossomed. And the difference for me had been the produce. And, you know, you can always get your meat and you can always find your seafood, and whether you fly it in or stuff. The biggest challenge in the Midwest has been produce, because it's, other than 3.5 months a year, it's all got to be flown in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, everything's picked a little younger to last a little longer. So that's been the biggest challenge. But I think, you know, I found a lot of different vendors and places to buy them from and do that, and then we all look forward to that 3.5 months a year.
Yeah. I just talked to Paul Durant, and he was talking about how, you know, he's doing a ton of pickling and preserving so he can get, you know, some of the stuff at the height and use it, you know, throughout the year. And, you know, sure, that's no substitute for the fresh, but, the, you know, it's at least hopefully one way to to get at the seasons out of season. So.
Yeah, I think the last of the season in August, I bought 250 pounds of red torpedo onions and did the same thing, pickled them, and I just ran out last week. So,
did you?
You know, it lasts a while. You know, and then you have some of them at a cellar, some apples for you until it runs out. And
you know, as I was looking at your menus and kind of reading about you a little bit, it seemed like a theme was this idea of, you know, taking comfort food and kind of building on it and sort of a gourmet way or a fine dining way. And you know, so of course I see, you know, you have some really good staples on there like pad thai and pho and that kind of thing. And is that a challenge for people? I mean, you know, I would say that, you know, a lot of people who are food aware, although not everybody's food aware, but in Chicago, you know, somebody's like, well, I go to Argyle Street and, you know, $5 and get a good bowl of pho versus, you know, come in Aria. Do you find that that's a tough sell for you sometimes? Or, you know, people are, you know, open and they're like, hey, you know, this is going to be a better version. I don't know. Is that a challenge for you?
It's not necessarily really a challenge. That's the, I mean, it's the fun part of the, of, you know, having a menu like that, that we can do different things that are on there. You know, we have, I believe the people coming to Aria that we have as far as the regulars are very loyal to us, and they're willing to experiment. And say you come in with a, you know, a six top will come in, inevitably you're going to have two people that'll order a steak. That's just what's going to happen. But then from there you'll start to see that people will order a pad thai or a chow mein or the tuna, you know, or order the shrimp come on as an appetizer or the rock shrimp. And so then they'll start to experiment and share, and then they'll talk about it, and the wait staff's very knowledgeable about, you know, history behind the food and talking about it. So, and then it broadens their horizons. And so next time they come in, they end up willing to experiment and try, because people are creatures of habit, and if they're uncomfortable, they will go to the same place and order the same thing, and that's what we try to break everybody out of. Instead of, like, fine dining, it's more, like you said, it's gourmet, fun atmosphere that's in there, you know. The naan bread to start off with, so you put the naan bread out in the dipping sauce as well. Not everybody likes to go out to Indian food or will try it, so you get them exposed to trying naan bread, and they're like, oh, wow, this is actually really good. You know, the different kinds of potatoes, you know, that I serve with all the entrees is more of the American kind of comfort food, but not everybody's going to try smoked fingerlings.
Sure.
And not everybody's had good sweet potato mash, you know, so, you know, that, and then the orange bark that we serve at the end is kind of the French sort of, you know, finish to a meal. So we try to, like, consciously and subconsciously, like, interject little parts of the world along in with the meal and add them to it, and then try and broaden everybody's horizons with it.
My experience is that Aria is not really, I mean, it's in a hotel, but it's not really a hotel restaurant, so to speak. I think, you know, hotel restaurants sometimes get a bad rap, and, you know, clearly in Chicago that's changing. You know, obviously Avenues has kind of proven that, and Know Me, and you know, and frankly, I think you guys are doing a good job as well. And but at the same time, you know, is it a different game than, you know, the fine dining game? I mean, you know, like a separate restaurant, you know, that's out there that just exists on it at its own. Is there something inherent in that you like or that you don't like? I mean, it seems like you've kind of gone the hotel route in your career so far. I'm curious maybe why you chose that route. Or
I went freestanding restaurants first. And I did country clubs, and then I did hotels, and I enjoy the hotels for the stability of it and the resources of it. And I think here in this hotel, Aria and the hotel, it's kind of the best of both worlds. Aria is basically a freestanding restaurant that's marketed like that, that's run like that, that doesn't have the same rules and regulations as a lot of hotels say that these are the kind of cuisines that you have to have, and you have to have this many of this, and you have to have this, and here's corporate menus. So we don't have any of that. So we really run it to, as Aria, as, you know, the mantra of, you know, culturally inspired and culturally American. So we kind of go with that, and then as long as we're doing well, just like any other restaurant, you're left alone by anybody.
Right.
So, you know, that's the best of both worlds, and that's why I really came here, was for not only for the hotel, but really for the restaurant, to say, okay, you know what, this is a freestanding restaurant. It's part of the hotel, but it's really not.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, you go in there, and you don't see anything about the hotel in there, and it's just, it's different, and it's the fine dining without the white tablecloth kind of experience that's in there, because I didn't want it to be, I don't think any of us here wanted it to be a special occasion restaurant, because that's not what it's, not what this restaurant's about.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you can see it even, like, you guys wear chef's blacks, not chef's whites, so it's kind of different? Where did that come from? Is that just a choice you guys made, or is it? Yeah, I mean, most people wear white, so I think it's cool, but.
Yeah, most people wear whites, and in trying to stand out and being a little bit different, and the black kind of works in with the restaurant, and the logo itself with the colors and stuff that blend in with those kind of spice market, you know, tour as it was, those, you know, kind of mellow oranges and reds and browns, and try to pull a little bit of that in there with it. It's just something that's a little different to make mm-hmm. it stand out. Not so more casual, mm-hmm. but still a uniform, per se.
Are you a big fusion Asian guy, or what are your interests in terms of cooking? I mean, obviously you're doing that kind of thing here, but is that what you love, or are there other things that you really are influenced by or that you really like to cook?
I think for a lot of chefs, I mean, Asian is a big part of it, because I think that's what a lot of us like to eat, is the, you know, the raw tuna and the sushi and then the Asian, the noodles, and it's kind of a lot of our comfort food, I think, is really what it comes down to. That's a lot of what you see kind of influencing the menu, because that's what people are asking for. What I prefer is not necessarily a cuisine, but it's that whole idea of I get more excited about when the seasons change. I get more excited about, you know, May 17th when the market opens.
Sure.
You know, that's what for me is exciting, as you know, as the new stuff starts to come in and the old stuff starts to go out, and what's going to be coming in, what's going to be really good this year. And I'm not talking food trends. I'm talking what producers are out there that have changed their soil enough to have the most amazing heirloom tomatoes that I'll be able to use, you know, from mid-July until the end of September. That's what I get more excited mm-hmm. about.
So I know you're doing the cook with the chefs thing at the Green City, or you did that in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And, how's that experience been? I mean, are you teaching a lot of Chicagoans, you know, how to finally pick good stuff and how to do it, you know, that maybe people didn't have that awareness before? Has that been a rewarding experience? Is that something that you feel like you're making a difference?
I feel like I'm making a difference because, you know, it had a slow start last year, and then it really started to take off the end of the year. And we decided to do it because I'm down there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's be honest, I'm there every Wednesday and Saturday anyway. So I might as well take some people with me and make lunch out of it. And I had set up this whole elaborate sort of, you know, let's talk about seasonality, and let's talk about the different varieties, and let's talk about this, that, and whatever it came down to was just that, was the fact of, you know, how do I pick the best onion, and what's the best asparagus, and what do green beans really need to look like or taste like? You know, how big should zucchini get before you don't buy it anymore? And that's what it became, and it just became a, you know, what I thought was going to be a half-hour walk through the market turned into, you know, 2.5 hours there and another 2.5 hours here, and, you know, an all-day sort of lunch experience, which is fine for me because I educate about organics, which I'm very, you know, big into, educate about seasonality, which is something I'm very big into, and supporting your local market, which is, I mean, three big things for me is really what I'm, the things that I really enjoy doing.
How much organic do you guys use here at Aria?
I use as much as I really possibly can. A lot of the greens and stuff are organic. It's much more in the summer based on availability. It's not strictly all organics, because I can't really do that.
Mm-hmm.
But as we get into it, especially during the summer, it'll be almost probably 95% organics based on availability.
What's the market like locally for organic? I mean, are a lot of farmers now adhering to that? I know it's tough for them, so... You know, I would guess not everybody does it, or they're strictly organic. What's the market like around here?
It varies. I mean, you have your strict organics that are there, then you have the integrated pest management ones that only do what they can, and then you have the ones that are in transition that have been chemical before but aren't using anymore, but are in between being certified organic and not. And so you find a little bit of a range in there. And it's been down at the market. I mean, it's... you know, you get a little bit of everything, and they're all, it says right on there which ones are which, and it's a good variety of it. And then there's even like Red Hen Bakery that's there. They have
mm-hmm.
great bread anyway, but you can only get all organic bread at the market.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of their little ploy that's there, and that works for them, and that's where I pick my bread up from.
Huh,
you know?
I didn't know that. So they just bake small batches for the, okay, I didn't know that. So what do you do when you're not cooking?
Actually, you know what, you know, I haven't done really that much. I mean, I've been in the city 2 years now. You know, my son's...
You live in the city, or you...
I live in the city. I live up in Wrigleyville now.
Okay.
My son's 20 months old, and so that's really been the whole experience, is really kind of learning the city with him, you know, and my wife, you know, exploring and doing some of the festivals and going to the museums and going to the aquarium and, you know, taking him to the children's museum. And then, of course, you know, as much dining out as I can possibly do in the city.
Yeah.
You know, trying to find a little hole in the walls. And I'm still trying to find the, you know, the mainstream top 10 to see what they're doing. But, you know, I'm looking for the little sushi places and looking for the little noodle houses on the side.
Do you get down to Chinatown or go up to Argyle a lot?
Not too much up to Argyle, but I do get down to Chinatown about, you know, once a month.
Yeah.
I'm down there. I go down for bubble teas, really, is what I go down for.
Yeah, a little Joyee's. Do you have any favorite places down there that you really like, or any standout? There's like a dish or a chef that's doing something that's special.
Well, the Phoenix House, they have great sesame balls. That's what I always end up grabbing when I'm down there. And then it just depends, you know, walking through and just trying little different ones. Depends on what's hanging in the window, to be honest with you, what looks better than the next one down there.
Yeah.
It's just I go down to try the different bubble teas and, like I said, over to Phoenix for dim sum. So.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many places, it's so hard to figure it out. I go to Spring World a little bit, Lao Szechuan, and, you know, occasionally if I see a good duck hanging, like you said, if I see a good duck hanging in the window, I'll stop in. And
yeah, if it smells good and the duck looks good, that's when you're in.
Absolutely. There's a good bakery, I think Chai Kwan, which is like... I want to say it's on the Wentworth Strip, and they have like really good like buns, you know, like the Asian steam buns and the stuffed ones, you know, like not like the Wild Bao type, but more like they have like the crust on them, but then they're soft and chewy inside, and they're really good. So might be something to check out. When we were when we met at the big Red event, you said you had some big tattoos.
It tends to be it's a little. I didn't start small. I went big when I first started, and I have a traditional Japanese back piece that goes from the bottom of my ass to the top of my shoulders.
Yeah.
It's not even finished yet. I have about 67 hours into it so far.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it done in the traditional way, or it's done like with modern equipment?
It's done modern way, but it was all a unique, one of a kind piece that was basically just drawn on. By a gentleman in South Beach, and then it was just went from there.
Yeah.
It's a blue dragon with peony flowers and wind bars and such through
Very
it.
Very
so.
Cool. So are you going to the same artist, or are you getting it filled in up here or different places?
I lost track of the artist that I was using in South Beach, and he's gone. He has a lot of tattoo artists do.
Sure.
They travel, and I wasn't able to keep up with him. I haven't found one here yet.
Yeah.
Not one that I can trust, one that will do it correctly, but the artists generally in the city that are really good don't want to work on somebody else's piece.
Sure.
So it's a matter of finding somebody that'll do some other work on me and be able to finish it in, and that's kind of the trade-off that you go.
So is that kind of indicative of your attitude, and that you're kind of like, I'll go whole hog, and, you know, I don't do anything halfway, or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I'd always talked about tattoos and always wanted them, but I wanted to find the right ones. I wanted to do the whole thing, and I figured, you know what, I found the right guy, and we met, and we talked about it, and we went through it, and we really kind of hit it off personally, you know, as far as attitude, as far as, you know, talking about food and wine and just the world, and then I said, all right, well, if we're going to do this, let's do it right. Let's just go for it. And so we kind of drew it up, and after a couple of weeks, we went through it, and I did the outline in one sitting for about 12 hours with a couple little breaks and went, like you said, whole hog, and it's, you know, if you're going to do it right and do it all the way.
That's cool. I assume it was pretty painful.
There are different parts of it. Actually, the most painful part was not the spine, was actually right along the rib cage, along the side. And that was a painful part. That's kind of the nail biter as it was. The rest of it, you kind of tune in and tune out as it goes through, and some places are more annoying than other places, but the rib cage right along the side,
yeah,
that was pain.
Is your wife a big fan? Is she?
It's grown on her, and she's used to it. I had it before we met, so it was always there. And she has none, but she's waiting to get her first.
Yeah, I don't have any, but I've always wanted to, and I've been thinking about it. I think it's cool. I thought... When I was talking to Graham Elliott-Bowles, I think what he said was really interesting was, you know, even if it's like, you know, something, you know, when I'm 60 and I look at it and I'm like, you know, for me, it's going to remind me of what I loved in my youth and who I was. And I think that's great. You know, I think there's no better thing, you know, and, you know, there's no reason to have regrets over those things. And, you know, and
you can't take it off. You have no regrets. That's exactly right. And I think Elliot's right. I mean, in the sense of, you know, a lot of people have a lot of tattoos, and if you look at them and you talk to somebody about their tattoos, it's all, it's the travel of their life. It's the different experiences. It's the struggles. It's the joys. It's all the different stages in their life. And that's, I mean, like you said, it's the storybook of somebody's life that they decided to put on their body. And you look back on it, and when you're 60 or 70 years old and your grandkids are over, and you're like, your grandkids are looking at it going, what's that, Dad? You know, Grandpa, what's that? And then you can say, oh, you know, when I was this, you delete a lot of the stuff out for little kids and tell them, you know, the good parts of the stories or the bad parts.
Yeah, and they tell me bad parts when they're older.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
What are your thoughts now that you have a child on raising them and, you know, food consciousness and that kind of thing? I mean, is that something that, you know, do you have a, I mean, I don't know if you even think about that, maybe you don't, but I would guess as a chef and you do, and what, you know, do you have an idea of how you want your kids to think about food and how they, you know, proceed in life towards that with their attitude?
You know, I want them to perceive and get the world of food kind of like how I had it growing up. Not strict, you know, vegan, you know, vegetarian, but I want them to be open, and I want them to see and experience as much as they possibly can. You know, I said my son is 21 months old, and then I have my daughter who's actually going to be born in June. So I have, thank you. So I have one of each, and from the very beginning, it's been all organics. It's been, you know, some very little milk kind of in there, but it's all soy, and it's all, you know, hormone free.
You guys make your own baby food, or?
We did. Yeah. We made some of our own, and then, you know, the organic stuff that's on the market as far as some of the baby food's fantastic, and all the vitamins and all the stuff that's in there. And then as, you know, my son started to eat solid foods, he ate what we ate. And so, you know, I don't know if there's too many, you know, one-year-olds that go out to dinner in Aria and sit down and, you know, eat, you know, Morel mushroom ravioli and risotto and rock shrimp and, you know.
Lucky kid, man. I'm jealous. I had to wait like 20 years before I figured it out.
But I mean, I think that's, you know, as a chef, it's important for me for my kids to understand food, respect it, and live a healthy life. And I think a lot of kids, and it's no fault of parents, no fault of people, but a lot of people don't know how to eat healthy. They just eat what they've been trained, and as they grew up, and this is what my parents did and my grandparents did, and so, you know, to instill that in my kids at a very young age, to eat your greens and eat vegetables, and it not be like you and I had, as far as, you know, I hate Brussels sprouts and I can't stand the cauliflower. I'm sure there are going to be things that he's not going to eat, but to not start with that stigma in their head. And so that's what's really important to me. And that's my, I really want to make sure in it, and I, you know, I always put new things in front of him, and I always, you know, last night he had steamed mussels, and I wasn't sure if he was going to like mussels. But he ate them, and he liked them, cool. and he just plowed through it. So, you know, he's like a lot of other kids, though, too. He still likes his bread, he still likes his pasta, but it's, you know, homemade macaroni and cheese with turkey sausage in it.
Nice.
You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I remember my mom said there was a period where my parents were worried because I wouldn't eat anything except McDonald's. When I was like two, I was like French fries. And they were like, they couldn't get me off the French fry diet. So I fear I will keep my kids, I'll try to keep my kids away from that. I read Fast Food Nation a couple of years ago, and I stopped ever even getting near fast food as much as possible because it was an eye-opener. It was interesting. It was really interesting, too, because when we were at Big Red, David Burke had those flavor sprays. Mm-hmm. And I just, I don't know, it just didn't seem right to me in some way. I mean, I don't know. It's artificial flavoring, and it's just, yeah, I don't know. But
yeah, I mean, it's teach their own, I mean, as far as that stuff goes. I mean, I had read, too, that it was interesting because they were, you know, urine testing adults and urine testing small kids, and they were finding that small children had a huge amount of pesticides in their system because they couldn't process it as well as we as adults can. So just from the outsides of regular vegetables, and just from that, they were getting these huge amounts of pesticides into their systems, and it just kind of fortified for me the whole idea of, you know what, I don't want my kids to have this. If that's what they choose when they grow up, that's great. But as long as I give them the foundation and eat healthy to start off with. Because I know my mom did it for me, and everybody yelled at her, you know, your kids didn't drink enough milk, and they didn't eat any red meat, and they're going to break their bones, and they're going to be brittle. Well, you know, I played football and baseball and basketball and swimming, and I never broke anything, and I'm 6'5". So it didn't stop my growth either. So, you know, mom did the right thing when it wasn't really the right thing to do. And I just want my kids to be healthy. And if I give them that foundation, they can make their own decisions later and let them go from there.
Being a chef's tough. I mean, it's long hours and that kind of thing. What if your kids grow up? Would you encourage them if they wanted to be chefs? Is that something that you would do? Or would you, you know, they always say, like, you know, like folks who are blue-collar people, you know, always want their kids to be doctors and things like that. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I want my kids to do what they want to do. And if that's being a chef, that's great. If that's being a doctor, that's great. You know, if it's being the garbage man, that's great. As long as they love what they're doing, you know, and they're happy doing what they're doing, and they're not just doing something as a job, you know, I think that's the difference for them. And, you know, my wife was very, you know, worried because I played sports my whole life, and I joked that, you know, I want to retire by the time my son is 18 years old when he plays professional baseball. But, daddy's kind of dream. But if he ends up playing the violin, that's great. Let him play the violin or let him do choir, let him do dance, whatever he ends up wanting to do. But, you know, to support them in what they do, whether it's a chef or not,
I think you got to show them that there's a whole world of options out there. And
I think a lot of that for me comes from the way I grew up as a small child and in a kind of hippie household as it was, you know, born in the back of a bus by a lake out in the middle of the woods and that sort of existence for a little while. And that sort of mentality through it, you know what, you can do whatever you want to do in life, but just make sure it's what you want to do and that you put all your heart and soul into it if that's what you want to do in your life.
Do you still have some of that lifestyle in you? I mean, do you listen to Fish or like Grateful Dead or any of that stuff, or do you have different musical interests? I don't know.
I listen to some of it. You know, I went to I don't know how many Dead shows as a kid growing up, and you know, like growing up on the West Coast and in Eugene around that environment, and you know, Ken Kesey and the Magic Bus, and you know, that whole sort of electric Kool-Aid acid test environment, and I grew up around a lot of those kids, and you know, I have some of it. I'd listen to a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not so much, you know, after a dozen or so Dead shows, it's I don't own any Dead CDs, but I'll listen to it on the radio.
Sure.
It's more the blues for me and the jazz for me, and then even, you know, it's everything, except for pretty hardcore rap is not something I can actually get into, and I think that I try and stay and keep an open mind, whether it's, you know, blues or jazz or rock or pop even, because I don't want to be the old man and not have my kids, you know, not understand or relate to my kids as they grow up.
That's right. You got to keep up with Third Eye Blind.
That's right.
Or Fall Out Boy, I guess is the big one right now. Do you get out to hear any live music, like any of the places around here now? Probably not. You're working nights a lot.
Yeah, I'm working nights a lot. And when I'm not, I'm generally trying to, you know, to dine more than I'm trying to do see the music scene as it was.
Yeah.
My wife keeps me in tune. She does a lot of the downloads and stuff like that from the internet. And she buys the CDs, and she's the music hound in the house. So
yeah.
She keeps me abreast of it was. If it was just me, I'd probably have Johnny Cash in my tape deck as it was instead of the CD player.
There's nothing wrong with that. 8-track was fine for Johnny. So I don't think he'd mind.
Nope.
So what kind of things are you excited about food-wise right now? I mean, say you're the one thing you do is you get to dine out. I mean, are there some people or some chefs that you've eaten lately that you're just, you know, you're really inspired by right now?
There's not a whole lot of, for me, it's more so the cuisines and stuff like that. I mean, I think right now my favorite little spot I love going to is Avec. Because they have the idea of the small plates, and they're going in there, and, you know, their dates are great, their focaccia is great. You know, the braised octopus, you know, the fresh sardines once in a while when they have them. And that's what I, you know, that's kind of a nice, it's like a comfort place for me, really. And that's kind of, I think that's kind of why I like it. You know, the big benches that are in there. You sit at the bar, you sit at the benches. But it's really just experimenting in the city for me right now. And that's, you know, it's not a favorite place or a favorite cuisine. It's just checking it all out, kind of seeing what's there.
Yeah, Ryan Polley said he loves Avec too. That's the seems to be a chef favorite. And I know it's because they're open late night and things like that. So.
Yeah, they're open late night, and it's, you know, nothing super expensive, and you can go in with a bunch of people, and you can all, you can try a bunch of different things. And I think, you know, I don't know about when you go out to eat, but when I go out to eat, generally everybody knows that they're going to go out to eat with me. Everybody's sharing it.
Yeah,
you know, it may end up back in front of you if that's your favorite thing, but if you're going to go out, we're going to get as many dishes as we can, and we're going to try as many different things as we can.
Yeah, that was definitely a value that was in my family growing up, and it's a value that, you know, thankfully I married a good woman who also believes in that philosophy, or we'd have some issues. So, yeah, and friends too. You gotta, you know, it's community experience. It's about sharing good times and things like that. I think one of the things I want to do more with Hungary, you know, is celebrate, you know, almost the food as secondary. It's what does the food do? You know, it brings together community and people, or, you know, in some cases it's the inspiration for a career or whatever it is. Because I think those are the things that are really what's most important about food in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. I think a lot of it gets lost. I mean, in the end of the day, what I really do is I cook. I'm a cook.
Yeah.
You know, I manage people and I cook.
Yeah.
And I think that gets lost a lot of times in food and in the world of an executive chef or the world of a celebrity, you know, because after Emerald really took Food Network to a whole different level, it changed the whole world of how we were viewed.
Yeah.
You know, it was all men in the kitchen, but at home, it was the wife that cooked, mm-hmm. which I've never understood. If you were a chef, you were a man. If you cooked at home, you were the woman.
Right.
And I think that, you know, it's, like you said, it's a community of it. It's like, you know, some of my best experiences of going out to eat hasn't really been the food. It's been, you know, it was a great time. We were with really good people. Service was unobtrusive and almost not even there. And I mean, I think that's kind of great service in itself, that everything you need is ever there, and they're never, you never even notice, you know, a server that's around. The food was fantastic, but it was the whole package. It's the whole idea of, you know, the people that you're around and really what you got out of the experience and what you remember from it.
Yeah. You know, I caught Felicity Huffman talking about the Oscars yesterday or something like that, and she was talking about how her whole family flew in a week ago or whatever to celebrate her Oscar nom, but they just flew in to eat dinner together. And I was like, you know, that's it, you know, it's like sometimes that's all it is, you know, it's just a good dinner and celebrating with friends, so.
Yeah, and I think part of that was, you know, how I grew up. It was no matter where you were at during the week, no matter what happened, Sunday nights was dinner together, no matter what. No excuses, no nothing. The family ate dinner together on Sunday nights.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing. I think that's lost in today's, you know, when everybody working and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Did you have, you know, since you were in Hawaii, I know that spam's a big thing out there. Something. Did you have any spam recipes that you, or did you stay away from that? Was that
you know, the first almost full year that I was there, I stayed away from it as a stigma of, you know, it's canned processed meat. But, you know, I play golf, and out there when you play golf, you know, we're out on the golf course or whatever, and the big thing out there is was spam musubi,
uh-huh.
you know, which is basically sushi rice, fried spam on top, and wrapped in nori. Sounds very strange, but you know what? It was actually pretty good.
Hey.
That for me was my spam experience, and, you know, for myself, but they eat it everywhere. You know, it's funny, you're driving down the street or you see a commercial on TV and you got McDonald's advertising for breakfast, two scoops of white rice, fried spam, and eggs. And that's just, I mean, that's Hawaii. That's the culture there. Everybody
right.
eats spam. It's cheap, canned meat.
Yeah.
It doesn't taste that bad, but it's not something I'm going to, unless I'm playing golf in Hawaii again, I don't think I'll put it on my plate.
Are you a TV watching golfer guy, or just purely go out and do it?
Both. I mean, well, I played a lot when I was in Hawaii, obviously, because it was just my wife and I. My son wasn't around, and I worked for Kapalua, so it was free golf. So,
yeah.
But I find myself playing less and less and watching more and more. So.
I bet. What's your game like? How good are you?
Not very good. I'm
not
about
very good.
A 14 handicap right now. So.
Yeah, I haven't golfed in years. I you know, I liked it, but it was always one of those things where you, if you're going to be good at it, you almost have to put as many hours as you're putting in the kitchen to be that way. And I always, at some point, it got frustrating, and so I just took some time off. But I love to watch it. I'm probably a Tiger Woods golf watcher. You know, in the sense of I got into it because of Tiger. But you know, I think the thing I like about Tiger is the. It's just the sense of a guy competing against himself at all times. You know, it's, you know, there's no one he's competing against out there. I mean, you could argue that there's a couple guys, you know, but for the most part, he's competing against history and against himself. And, you know, he seems to meet that challenge year after year. And, you know, sure, he had a little rough spot, but for him, that rough spot is like most people's careers.
Yeah, exactly. His rough spot, he still pulled home, you know, $12 million.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, Tiger's one of those guys that, I mean, what, Sunday, yesterday, he won the Doral.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I was reading about him this morning, and it was saying the fact that, you know, he was playing against Toms in the end, and Toms never reached the reader board as far as what the scores are. And Tiger's like, I don't know how you can do that because you need to know how you're going to play. And he says he always reads it. And I think that it was interesting to hear, you know, Tiger talk about that in the sense that he needs to know how he plays at all times. And if he needs to be more aggressive or he can lay back a little bit. And, you know, he talked about having to go into the last hole that all he wanted to do was hit a, you know, it was a par four, and all he had to do was get a bogey to win. So he played it for a bogey, and that's what he ended up getting to win, because he knew already. And the difference was is that, you know, somebody's scrambling and the nerves get to him, and Tiger's always been that same sort of way as far as I know how I have to play and whether it's more aggressive or less aggressive to get me where I need to go. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always work,
yeah,
but he's got a pretty good average going for himself.
Yeah, he's doing all right.
Yeah.
What's coming up for Aria? Are there any, you know, obviously spring is coming up. You know, what kind of changes are you anticipating or things that you might be bringing to the menu?
Oh, it's going to be so much spring stuff coming in and the vegetables and stuff, you know. Not so much really for April, but I think we're really going to see a huge change in May as far as, you know, the spring into summer sort of, you know, vegetable experiences and some of the younger, you know, cheeses. And I'm working on a Nutella milkshake and banana ice cream right now. So it's kind of a different sort of... just fun little dessert.
That sounds
something
tasty.
You know, Nutella milkshake, banana ice cream, and a little homemade donut. So just something
nice.
Kind of a little fun. That's what I'm kind of working on right now for next month on the dessert side of it. And then
that reminds me of like Paris, you know, like the crepe stands. You know, they always have the Nutella on the banana.
Yeah, and I got the Nutella on the breakfast menu. So, you know, so just to put a little bit of that in there. And then really, like I said, I mean, getting into April and then into May, it's all about, you know, it'll be the spring asparagus and the pea shoots and the fiddlehead ferns came in a couple of weeks ago. And so, you know, those get thrown in for little specials here and there, depending on how they are. And, you know, the spring mushrooms and the spring chanterelles and, you know, growing up in the Northwest, you know, picking my own mushrooms and finding those in the woods and stuff, it's pretty much mushroom time now. As soon as that first rain stops, now they got like 50 days of rain in a row. As soon as that stops, we'll start to see the king boletus and the lobster mushrooms and the chanterelles. And I mean, even the early morels coming through.
Yeah. Well, the morels, I was talking a little bit with Paul Verlana because he does a little mushroom foraging on his own. And he was saying how, you know, morel pickers are crazy. Like how some guy called him, he'd read about him in Chicago Magazine and said, you know, hey, I got these morels, you know, are you interested? And Paul likes to track the season, you know, and he just was curious where the guy was calling from. The guy wouldn't tell him where he was calling from, and, you know, he's had guys who are like, I'll take you out, but I'm going to have to blindfold you, and things like that.
They're really aggro like that. I mean, and the guy that I went with in Oregon was like that. I mean, he would take you, but he said, okay, you know, you got to swear you're not going to tell anybody, and we'd had that relationship for me buying from him for a while. You know, but because we're going out for Matsutakis, and, you know, the Matsutake, the praised full veil cap that gets, you know, the Japanese, you know, ooh and ah over, and really, it's, you know, it's their livelihood, and, you know, I don't think last year was as bad as it had been in the past as far as, you know, the prices on the vendors on the side of the road selling them, but, you know, there's places like Fresh and Wild and, you know, all these other ones that sell you, and they're buying from all these guys. But really, once the season hits, I'll get, you know, 6 or 7 phone calls a week. Hey, you want to buy some mushrooms?
Yeah.
And that's the, unfortunately, that's the bad thing about in a big hotel environment is that laws and signs and stuff like that, you know, I can't do that.
Yeah.
When I was in the smaller restaurants, the guys show up at the back door with a brown bag full of mushrooms, and you're like, I'll take these and I'll take these, and it's, you know, half the price of what I'm paying for them now.
Yeah, but yeah, there's the line, and it's tougher to cross it. I understand. So what's your vision for the restaurant? What do you want to do with it? I mean, you've only been here a year, so you're still probably getting, you know, in the early stages of what you're going to do or what you'd like to do. What are your thoughts on what you want Aria to be, or maybe it is already, I don't know, but maybe you have an idea for what you want it to become in the end.
Well, I've actually almost been here almost 2 years.
Okay.
And it's continuing to evolve. And, you know, I think what I originally wanted to do was get some of that influence into the menu, where I'd come from and where I'd been in my past as far as Hawaii and the Northwest, and have that sort of my comfort food, as it was, influenced into the menu. And I think that with this last summer, with the market and the organics, you know, that was the next step for it. And then I think this year for me, it's really focus on that into the menu, and really to get my, you know, the cooks and the staff involved in it.
You're on death row. What's your last meal? What would you eat?
I think the meal that I most remember when I started will be the meal that I have at the end. It'll be brown rice and miso soup with watercress in it.
Nice. So say you're throwing a dinner party, and you can invite anybody living or dead. It doesn't have to be culinary. Who would you want there? Who would you want to talk to?
You know, people in history. I think I'd like to have Julia Child there. I'd like to have James Beard there. I'd like to have JFK there. Martin Luther King Jr. Lincoln. I think, you know, those are just a few I can think of right off the top. I think more of a, that's just a few. Some food, some not food, some political, some, you know, not really political, but I think the more diverse your crowd of people you have for a dinner party, the more apt the conversation is to go in different directions and people have a good time. Because yeah. I think if everybody agrees on the same thing and everybody has the same views about everything, everybody's going to eat dinner and say thank you and go home and never really have a conversation.
Right, or they're too comfortable with one another. They don't have to, don't feel challenged. Or
I still stay away from talking about religion and politics at dinner, though, of course.
Uh-huh. Which would be tough if you invited JFK, yeah. Martin Luther King. And
yeah, but still, I think people like that, you know, being younger and not really being able to be around those kinds of people at the height of their careers.
I don't know if there's anything I'm missing or anything that you feel really strongly about or that you're really interested in that you want to talk about. Or, you know, I know that, you know, you are pretty active in the community. I know you do stuff with Common Threads and, you know, you've done a lot of stuff, but I don't know if I just make sure there's nothing I'm missing or that we should talk about.
I mean, I think we hit a lot of stuff as far as professionally, you know, what I am most passionate about and professionally as far as what I do. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a job and it's a career, and I'm very thankful for everything that it's been able to provide for me. But at the end of the day, you know, what do you want on the epitaph when you're dead? Do you want, you know, to be a great executive chef? Well, that's down the rung for me. What I want to be known as is a great father, a great husband, a great community person, as it was. And those are things that are most important for me. My wife, my son, my soon-to-be-born daughter. You know, those are things for me that I'm extremely passionate about. And food is obviously a big part of anybody's household. So, you know, be thankful to have that in there with it. And I am kind of a private person in that sense. You know, I don't throw a lot of dinner parties.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a lot of people come over to my house. That's not to say that I won't, but I got a pretty small house.
Yeah, and you got to find your own private time. I mean,
exactly.
You're in the public all day long. You know, I completely understand that. It's tough. Are you? You alluded to sports a little bit. Are you a Cubs fan or a Sox fan, or are you not Chicago at all because you didn't really grow up here?
You know, I was a Yankee fan growing up because my father was from Brooklyn. I moved to Chicago, and my father hates me for this, but I've become a Cub fan, and it's hard not to be because, you know, I'm a block and a half from left field, and so, you know, for 2 years what I've heard during the summer is the roar of the crowd and singing of, you know, take me out to the ball game for seventh inning stretch. So it was very hard for me not to become a Cubs fan. People in the hotel and Southside obviously think I'm a traitor, but for not being a huge Sox fan. But I'm a Cubs fan.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in a blue-collar family, and I've eventually become a Sox fan, but when I first moved here, Wrigley was the pull. I mean, everybody grows up watching WGN because it's the national thing, and you see the Cubs. And, you know, and there is the one thing you can say is that there is that tradition and the old stadium, and you know, and man, that grass is no greener than anywhere I've ever seen, and it is a great thing. So,
yeah, and I went to 6 games last year. It's probably more games than I've been to in a really long time, and it's just, you it's a whole different feel in Wrigley Field because you're right on top of the field. It's like you're in a college stadium or, you know, a high school stadium watching a professional baseball game because, you know, unless you're sitting behind one of the poles, you can pretty much see everything and hear everything that's going on. And the closer you get down, you can smell that grass and hear the guys and see the dugouts. And everybody's right there, you know. And
you feel like you're part of the game in some ways, unlike the newer stadiums where you feel like you're, like, pitched at, like, a 50-degree angle hanging out the field.
Yeah, make sure you bring your binoculars to be able to see who's on first. You know, or watch the game on the big screen because you can't see the field.
Yeah. One little aside, it was just funny. I interviewed Doug Sown, Hot Dog, and he was saying he actually brings his own hot dogs to Wrigley, which I thought was great. I mean, makes sense, but he's like, I just gave up on them.
Yeah, I mean, it's that whole, you know, it's that part of the franchise has become the big business. It's like, you know, it's like going to the movies. You spend three times as much getting popcorn and a soda than you do getting into the movies. And unfortunately for ball fields around here, I mean, not knocking the stadiums, but the food's not that good.
Mm-hmm.
And Chicago has picked up on, especially what like LA has picked up on, as far as you're going for, you can go get gourmet food at the ball game and take it down to your seat.
Seattle has the ichi roll, I believe. Yes. The sushi.
Yeah. So I mean, it's that sort of thing that the West Coast has really picked up on that it hasn't been picked up on in other places. And you know, it's still a bad, whether it be a bad dog or not, you're still going to get an Old Style or a Bud Light and a dog when you're at the game.
Sure, it feels right. Yeah, although you know, you'd have the Aria Concourse at Wrigley.
Yeah, there you go.
A little closer to home for you.
Yeah, it's have the food and walk down and, you know, get there.
Excellent. Cool. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a good chat.
This ends this culinary podcast for Hungry Magazine. Check out www.hungrymag.com for more. Three, two, one more time.